Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Elaine Cha. In 1987, St. Louisan John O'Leary was a 9-year-old boy who loved baseball and was fighting for his life after suffering severe burns to almost 90% of his body. His battle for survival captured the attention of the whole city, including one of its icons, St. Louis Cardinals announcer Jack Buck. And John's triumph against the odds from childhood through today is a story he shares as a motivational speaker and a 2-time best-selling author who's touched thousands of people across the world. That story is also the focus of a full-length feature film called Soul on Fire. It had its red carpet premiere right here in St. Louis last week. And tomorrow, Friday, October 10th, the movie hits theaters across the U.S. and Canada. And today we're getting kind of a sneak peek and some behind-the-scenes perspective on the film and the role that St. Louis plays in it from the biopic subject and inspiration, John O'Leary himself. John, welcome back to St. Louis on the Air.
Welcome back. Isn't that great? Elaine, It's great to be back.
So last week at Powell Hall was that premiere. There was a red carpet. People were very dressed up. So the first question, what were you wearing or who were you wearing?
No, 21 years ago, my friend told me, stop renting tuxedos and buy a cheap one.
Okay.
And I took his advice. I bought a cheap tuxedo 21 years ago, and I've probably worn it 11 times since to weddings and formal events, including the red carpet event. So I had on a 21-year-old tuxedo.
Okay, so going vintage is what you did. Who was there at the premiere, John?
So my mom, my wife, my 4 kids, all my siblings, all my friends, the nurses and caregivers from Mercy who treated me, a 91-year-old physician named Vachia Vajan, his partner in crime, Tom Vitale, who was there when I showed up in the emergency room. We had the producers, the investors, the actors, the guys who worked behind the scenes in sound and in lighting. And then we had a lot of VIPs from around St. Louis, including Ozzie Smith and Mike Matheny, and the Blues and the Cardinals and St. Louis City were all represented. So everywhere you looked, you saw someone you probably recognized, but more than that, you saw joy. Mm-hmm. It was just this celebration, partially of a film. I think it was a celebration of community.
Mm-hmm. How did it feel to be among so many people? You know, it kind of makes me think of on Sesame Street, they would do This Is Your Life.
Yes.
Was it a bit of a moment like that?
It remains a moment like that. I feel undeserving of all of this. We got picked up by a town car. We get out at the Powell, and I wasn't warned about how busy this was going to be, but there were flash bulbs everywhere. There were people clapping. I get out, I open up the door for my wife and kids. All 6 of us are stuck now on this red carpet. And it was unbelievable to be gathered by the actors and the director himself and all the media interviewing us. So that's wild. Then you walk into this gorgeous theater. Have you been in the Powell?
You know, I have not yet, but we've talked about it quite a lot on the show.
I'm telling you, folks who came in from LA and New York said, I cannot believe you have this in St. Louis.
Mm.
It is world class. It is brilliant. It looks great. It sounds better. And we got to host Soul on Fire there.
Mm-hmm. What a beautiful way to start that. Before we get into, you know, some of the background for why the film's premiere happened right down the street at Powell Hall, I'd like to start with where Soul on Fire and so much of your life begins. We noted in the intro that you suffered life-threatening burns when you were 9, and those injuries, you know, had their roots in something that is altogether ordinary, actually, in 9-year-olds, and that's curiosity.
Right on.
John, what happened back then?
So a week before I was burned, I saw kids in my neighborhood playing with fire and gasoline. And I figured if they could do it, Elaine, so could I. So I walked into my mom and dad's garage. This is actually where they filmed the scene that this occurred. So in that same garage space.
In that actual garage?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Out in town and country.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked into a little area where they kept the gasoline. I bent down, picked up a little piece of cardboard, lit it aflame, tried to pour the gasoline, just like I saw my friends doing. And before the liquid came out, the fumes inhaled my flame into the container, created this massive explosion, split the metal into a lane, picks up the 9-year-old kid, and launched me 20 feet against the far side of the garage. So it was this massive explosion, ripped that can in two, picked up me, lit me ablaze, and everything around me was on fire. And as you and your listeners know, when a flame, stop, drop, and roll. Mm-hmm. But when you're actually on fire, you panic.
Right.
And so I ran back into my mom and dad's house and eventually was put out by my brother Jim, who became the lifesaver of the year for the state of Missouri in 1987, a 17-year-old kid. Then my sisters served me in meaningful ways, and eventually they ushered me away from the house and into the hospital.
As you're telling this story, I'm imagining that as you were recovering in the hospital, was this a scene that was playing out in your mind over and over again?
You know, it's funny. The scene that was playing out in my mind as a 9-year-old in the hospital bed was one thought. My dad's going to kill me. He's my Boy Scout master. He's my dad. He's a veteran. He's a business owner. My dad is going to be so irate. So while hanging out in Mercy's emergency room, I wasn't thinking about the explosion. I wasn't thinking about burnt care. I was thinking about my dad's wrath. And then I hear my father's voice down the hall barking out at some poor nurse, "Where is my boy, John?" Mm-hmm. And this lady brings him back. I think she should have called security personally, but she brings him back, pulls back the curtain. And I watch as my father walked over to me. So I shut my eyes, Elaine. And then my dad says, "John, look at me when I'm talking to you." So I did. And then he added, "I've never been so proud of anyone in my entire life. And today, my little buddy, I'm just glad to be your dad." Mm-hmm. And then my father says, "I love you and there is nothing you can do about it." And as a little boy overhearing that, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, nobody told my dad what happened. You know, he must not know I burned down his house. And and yet you're a mother of a 9-year-old. I think you would have had a very similar response. Regardless of the cause, the love and the mercy you show to people you care about changes both people involved. Mm-hmm. So it changed my dad first, but I followed. And that did not make 5.5 months in hospital easy. What does? Doesn't make dozens of surgeries or amputations easy. But I think his love on day one made that journey possible.
So that made the biggest difference.
Undoubtedly. In congruence with that, my mother came in. And my mom is just a warrior. And I remember she took my right hand and she patted my bald head. And she said, "Baby, I love you." So I said to her, "Mama, knock it off with the love. Am I going to die? You know, I'm looking at my body. It's burned everywhere. Am I going to die?" And she said, "Baby, do you want to? It's your choice, not mine." And I said, "Mom, I don't want to die. Gosh, I want to live." And her response was, "Good, then look at me. You take the hand of God. You walk the journey with God and you fight like you never fought before." She said, "Dad and I will be with you. We're not going to leave you, but you've got to do your part and fight." And on that first morning, January 17th, 1987, a child who had never been sick before took the hand of God and just started walking forward, fighting. And I think between my mother's challenge to do my part and my dad's response of love, that's a critical next step in making the journey possible. Mm-hmm.
The first time, John, that you shared this story was with a group of kids.
Well, you've done your homework.
Right. So you were an adult. This is many years after your recovery. And that audience was a group of Girl Scouts. And before you talked with them, you barfed. You, John O'Leary, you threw up, right? Not in front of them, just to clarify.
That's what I did before radio shows, too, Elaine. So don't think you got off easy today.
What made you so nervous about telling your story then? And why did you go through with it?
Yeah. Well, what made me so nervous is I'm an introvert. I had never told friends how I got burned as a kid. My roommate drove me down here. His name was Patrick Berry in college, and he's still a dear buddy today. But I never told Patrick how I got burned. Why talk about bad things? As a child, I committed to putting it behind me and never looking back. And that is what I did. I never looked back at being burned. And then at age 28, I get a call from a little Girl Scout to say, "Mr. John, will you speak at my troop?" And almost on a dare, I said, yes, I'll do that. So in the Hollywood version of this, they had me in front of 6 Girl Scouts. Mm-hmm. Not a very big audience. The reality was it was 3.
Oh, my gosh.
So I get sick in front of 3 Girl Scouts, put a piece of gum in, walked in, did my thing, did a lousy job of laying. But on the walk out, a dad pulled me aside and said, John, that was terrific. Would you speak at my Rotary Club?
Oh.
And I said, yeah, I'll do that. Mm-hmm. And then there was someone from Qantas and then a Chamber of Commerce and then a prison system. And it was never planned to be on NPR, never planned to sell books or have a movie made. The plan was to be a service. And in time, what I recognized, the story is not about me. It's not about my scars or wounds or explosion. It's about sharing vulnerable pieces of the journey so others can recognize the beauty in their stories.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to invite you to this conversation. If you have questions or comments for John, or if you're excited about this Hollywood film that's been made in St. Louis about his life and the story that he's sharing with us today, give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. So understanding that there's a film, there are the books that you've written, and there's a way to get a message across. What stood out to me in watching the film was the number of questions that the kids had. Mm. Was that part of the reason, too, that you decided to share your story, that the questions that you were getting were ones that maybe kids were not afraid to ask, or that you had, you know, for or about yourself?
Yeah. So one of the reasons why I keep doing this work, whether it's in front of the 3 Girl Scouts or the 22 Rotarians or the 27,000 at the MGM, is because afterwards, always people come up to me and they say, John, it's nothing like your story, but. And then they talk about bipolar in the family. Mm. They talk about a bankruptcy. They talk about abuse. They talk about a struggle they currently face, a diagnosis that they don't want. And then they share their heart. And the only way I could stomach sharing the story as many times as I have, or now doing this so vulnerably in a film, I mean, this is our life out there now, is because it invites people to recognize the beauty of their life. And if we can keep people moving forward and draw them into a conversation about hope and a pragmatic view of optimism for their journey, I'm willing to risk putting myself out there for that.
Mm-hmm. So what were your first thoughts then, John, when the idea of your life story, and not just yours,
right,
that point you've put on about your wife, right? When that came up, had that been something you'd ever thought about before?
I always tell people, if you are saying they should do a movie about my life, you should run away from that person quickly. Okay. You know, like, so when someone leads with, they really should do a movie about me, I am that great. My encouragement, listeners, run quickly. I never thought that. I still don't think that. It's so awkward in so many regards. 9 years ago, I was in Vegas at a conference, and a woman approached me and said, could I turn this story into a movie? And I said, I don't know. I guess you could try.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave her the green light, but I never thought it would happen. Never in a million years. And so Linda Huntington built a team, got the screenplay written, hired a director named Sean McNamara, built up the funding sources. And then ultimately, as Sean came in town just to meet Beth, my wife, and John, and our kids and my parents, he recognized, John, one of the main characters in your story is St. Louis. I mean, St. Louis University, you and I record this in the shadows of SLU.
Mm-hmm.
It's brilliant. I showed him the church where I was married, where Jack Buck is buried, all these places that are iconic. And he realized we have to film here.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you give a green light to something, it does mean go. So clearly this is why you're here. This is a great spot also for us to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll pick up on this conversation with John O'Leary and what it's been like for him to see his life journey as a child burn survivor translated to the silver screen. Welcome back. I'm Eileen Cha. Let's return to our conversation with John O'Leary. John is a motivational speaker and best-selling author whose life is dedicated to sharing the story of his surviving life-threatening burns from a childhood accident and inspiring others to seek and pursue their purpose. A new feature film about his life called Soul on Fire hits theaters in the U.S. and Canada tomorrow. John, before the break, you were talking about who came to you with the idea for this film back in 2017. I asked you what you thought about it, and you made a point of saying that it's not just your life, but others. What did your wife, Beth, think about your telling your story in this particular medium?
Hopefully she's not listening right now, because she is a listener, so she'll be resentful right now. Beth is a private person. As am I. And the only way she or her husband could put this out there is if ultimately it's not about us. When you look at the film poster, it's a picture of the guy who portrays me in the film named Joel Courtney. But it's not his face as like a hero shot, arm in the air, extended how great he is. Mm-hmm. He's actually turned away from the camera. And it's a mosaic of every single person in the film who fought and bled and encouraged and prayed and showed up and served and supported this little boy and then eventually a man toward achieving something in his life. So it's really not a story of John's heroism or Beth's heroism. It's a story of our community coming together. And Beth recognizes in this world we live in, we need better stories of heroes, not the kind who wear blue tights and capes, not the kind who fly spaceships, but just ordinary folks who do the right thing and in doing so change a life.
You know, something that really stood out to me because I heard your story when I was working over at Big Brothers Big Sisters of Eastern Missouri. You're a board member there and a big brother. It was the way that this film does not present you as someone without flaws, someone without hurdles you're trying to get over, especially when you are a college student. So I'm not going to give any spoilers on that, apart from that part of the film really resonated with me as you were learning, as you were going along on your journey. Now, one of the people who has had a big part in your life and continues to is baseball, that is Baseball Hall of Famer, Jack Buck, and your relationship with him. He came to visit you in the hospital many times when you were there for those 5.5 months. Mm. And some of those moments are depicted in the film. Here's a preview of some of Jack Buck's sage advice for you.
You're going to face challenges when you get out of here, but you can still do almost anything. Maybe you can't play baseball, but you can own a team or be a manager. I never told you this, but when I first came to see you, they said you had no chance. Zero. You were not going to make it.
I didn't know that.
Most of them wrote you off, kid. But here you are. You did that. Don't let anyone write you off ever again. Especially you. Yourself. Understood?
Yes.
And that was William H. Macy as Jack Buck and James McCracken as a young John O'Leary. John, that moment in the film is very touching.
Yeah.
And Jack's words again were, don't let anyone write you off ever again, especially you yourself. There are people in your life who did not write you off, pivotal figures like Jack Buck. First, how did it feel to see that particular moment captured on screen?
Yeah. It's one of my favorite parts of the film. It's the culmination of this little boy who was so terribly burned, getting ready to launch home. It's a character, Jack Buck, portrayed by, I think, one of the greatest actors in the industry right now. William H. Macy is a gifted, gifted actor and a phenomenal human being. He's far more interested in hearing your story, Elaine, than he would be on bragging about his successes. He's a great guy, wonderful reflection of Jack Buck. One of my favorite scenes that takes place even right before that is when he enters into the hospital for the first time. And the camera starts low at the feet, and you just see these black shoes walk into a room. And then you see a chair get dragged across the floor toward the bed. which is rare at a burn center because it's a scary place. And then they dolly up and you actually can see Jack Buck, portrayed by William H. Macy, and the encouragement he whispers over this dying child. Kid, you will live. Keep fighting. John O'Leary Day at the ballpark will make it all worthwhile. And when you bookend those scenes of Jack's commitment to the hope of tomorrow, with him also saying, John, do your part. Don't let anybody give up on you. Needless to say, you, yourself, don't give up on you. And yet, as you watch that movie, you realize John does give up on himself. I don't ultimately give up, but for decades, I hid the beauty of my story. And I think Jack knew that was coming, and that's partially why he did even more things than that as the movie and as the life progresses.
Mm-hmm. Your interactions with William H. Macy, how could you tell that he really cared about your right. personal story?
So the first time he came in town, he's staying in St. Louis. It's away from home. He's never been here before. And I ask him if he wants to go to dinner. He just got in town, and immediately he texts me back, yes. So we pick him up. The whole drive down to this restaurant, I took him somewhere down here, was all focused on me and Beth. And tell me more about your dad. And do you know Joe Buck? What about, like, he just is grilling me over this life story. We sit down, my wife meets us down there, and it was like we were with an older friend. Mm. The conversation was triangulated. He was caring. He was careful. He cared deeply about Jack Buck, and he cared deeply about my story, my marriage, and my wife. So I think that's pretty illustrative of who he is, not just when he's in front of a camera, but when no one's watching.
Mm-hmm. Where did you have dinner?
Oh, man, we went to a little whiskey a barrel shop right down the street. He's a vegetarian.
Oh.
And so I think it recently closed down, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was a phenomenal little restaurant. Bill loved it. There's a great picture of I'm signing the bill, and William H. Macy is signing an autograph for someone. Okay. So welcome to my world, Elaine. I'm signing off the bills, and Bill Macy signs autographs.
Right. So you're on a bill basis now. That's great to know.
Well, and you would be too. He insists you call him Bill.
Yeah. You know, characters themselves really come off in the film as turning points. There are those moments, but they're pivotal figures. Were there certain moments of the film that took you back in ways that you did not expect?
Right. There's two meaningful ones. Every single shot was filmed where the thing happened. So that alone will tell you how gripping it was to be part of it and hopefully as a viewer to observe it. It's not Hollywood. It's real. It's St. Louis. It happened. The day where they filmed the fire, they didn't want to show a child burning, so they showed a point of view of the child. So the camera instead of John, that's mm-hmm. when you see what John is looking at. And so indeed, that is what I saw that morning, the house, the kitchen, into the family room I went, ultimately the front hall, and to look up and see my sisters and their reaction. Portrayed brilliantly by these young actresses. And then my brother Jim and what he does. So to be part of that set that day at my mom and dad's house, reliving that moment, not only from my perspective, but from my siblings, was gripping. That's in a difficult, painful way. But on the opposite side of the spectrum, near the end of the film, at the Shrine of St. Joseph, downtown St. Louis, they shoot the wedding. Mm-hmm. So it turns out, listeners, here comes the surprise conclusion. O'Leary survives the fire. Does get married, falls in love, finds this beautiful girl who takes his hand, and we get married. And so in the scene, it's called Dolly Left. So the bride begins walking down the aisle. She's wearing my wife's actual wedding dress.
Oh, wow.
So to see that and to see this girl who looks so much like Beth, and then everyone rises, and it's all my friends who were there 21 years earlier. It's family and friends. In the first row, you see John Corbett, my dad in the film. Right next to him, Stephanie Shostak, famous actors. But behind them are my mom and my dad, my real parents.
Mm.
And Elaine, it's so meaningful because my dad has Parkinson's disease. He can no longer stand. But when the director yelled out the word action, my heroic father grabbed the pew, willed himself up, and stands up. And there's this shot in the film where you see the actors in the first row, my parents in the second, and this resolute look of joy on my dad's face. All the more meaningful now because on May 30th, my father passed away. And some of the listeners and readers of my stuff, like, that's my hero. That's my guy.
Mm.
So he's not part of this joyful launch, but he's all over it. His fingerprints are all over this film.
That is beautiful.
It is. It's just what an heirloom that he gave us, that smile at the end of his life.
Mm-hmm. John, St. Louis is your hometown. And you had mentioned earlier that it was Sean McNamara who recognized a certain beauty here. And it's clear in watching the film that St. Louis is not only a place, it is a character in this work. What role has St. Louis played in your life story and the way that you have shared it in books and speaking engagements before?
Yeah. So I'm a speaker, which means I spend quite a bit of time on the road. It would be far easier to be in Chicago or Vegas or Orlando, some city like that that has a lot of conferences. We choose St. Louis. My wife's from this area. She grew up in Webster Groves. I grew up in Town and Country de Pere. There's a culture here that is unlike any culture anyplace else. I think the challenge we face, Elaine, is sometimes we are so familiar with our reflection that we don't see the beauty of it. It's very easy to point out the scars, and there are scars. It's very easy to point out the weaknesses, and we have plenty. And yet what Sean saw so clearly, and from those of us who can just pull back a little bit and step away from the headlines just for a little bit, we've got incredible people, remarkable generosity, an incredible arts scene, phenomenal universities, geographical backdrop that is, you can go from mountains essentially just 45 minutes southwest of us to the flat fields and everything in between, minutes from your back door. We're blessed. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when you live in that space, you don't recognize it.
Would you have made the film, John, if you had not been able to film it here?
Yeah, the plan was to film in Vancouver. There was a 35% rebate for films being shot in Vancouver. And Sean came in as a formality, one, to raise funds. We had to self-fund this film, and the money was all raised right here, part of our listener audience. Mm. They filmed our film. They funded our film. And so that was beautiful. Sean was in to thank some of those guys and ladies. But then he met my mom and my dad. Then he met my sister. Then he saw St. Louis U and Mercy and Keener Plaza, and he recognized we've got to do it here. So along with the film community here in St. Louis and around the state, some things began to work just perfectly so we could ultimately move laws in Jefferson City to begin filming here, get a tax credit here, a rebate. So Soul on Fire will be the first film to take advantage of that. But there's already about 7 more films lined up to take advantage of that, to shoot right here in St. Louis. And McNamara, our director, is already planning another film here in St. Louis.
Oh, any spoilers on that? Do you have to keep mum about it?
He told me to keep a little mum, but it does have a little bit to do with baseball. And it's another great movie.
Yeah. Before we go to our next break, you know, I'm thinking about Jack's words about not writing off. Do you feel like this was a move to do it all in St. Louis, this filming, a move that is in alignment with that charge? Don't let anybody write you off.
It's odd on the red carpet to shake and then hug William H. Macy and then John Corbett and then our director and then turn around and get a hug from the mayor of St. Louis and then turn to my left and our fire chief pulls me aside with 2 big old ladder trucks in front of this place and an American flag draped down between it, just saying, thank you for what you're doing for our community. I don't think I knew when the filming began that this was a community celebration, but I know it now. Yeah, it's a story of Jack Buck. It's a story of baseball. It's a story of great health care. It's a story of a beautiful woman who takes my broken hand. It's a story of our life, yeah. But that life unfolds in our beautiful community. Mm-hmm. So we choose St. Louis, and now we get to celebrate our community, not only in the filming of it here in St. Louis, but now as it's watched, not just at our local theaters, but around the country, around North America, and around the world. This is now a postcard that we can always celebrate to say, this is who we are as a community.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something about Iceland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have friends in Iceland, and they are going Thursday night to the first showing of Soul on Fire in Iceland.
Mm-hmm. Well, if that is not a picture of the reach of your story, I don't know what is. We need to take a quick break here, but we'll be back in a moment to continue our conversation with John O'Leary, author, motivational speaker, and executive producer of the feature film Soul on Fire. It is a biopic about John's life and hits theaters across the U.S. and Canada tomorrow. Welcome back. I'm Elaine Cha. This hour, we've been talking with St. Louisan motivational speaker and best-selling author John O'Leary. John is the subject of a new film called Soul on Fire. It's about his life's journey and hits theaters in the U.S. and in Canada tomorrow. John, we were talking earlier about St. Louis as a character. You mentioned the Shrine of St. Joseph, where your wedding took place. And there are a number of other locations that you mentioned. Was there a favorite place for you in the course of the filming?
Yeah. Well, I will answer that, but not before saying it. During that last break, I was able to go online and make my donation to NPR. So
oh.
I am now a contributing member myself. Who knew that we would knock out an interview and get an investment back into our community all during one break?
Oh, thank you so much.
Because you're right. They mentioned in passing that, isn't it nice to have conversations? I'm not yelling at you. You're not yelling back at me. And there's an awful lot of yelling in the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
I love NPR. I love what you're doing here in St. Louis. And so I'm honored to be now a member. So thank you for letting me do that during the last break.
Well, thank you.
Now send me my sweatshirt.
Yes.
Okay?
No, I was just going to say, you can pick one up. It's got a nice hood.
So you mentioned, is there a favorite place? Clearly, to have my mom and dad with about 400 other people behind the cameras at their house. This is the house where I was raised. This is the house where my mom still lives. And this is the house that is celebrated in the film now. So those moments are so sweet from the film that took place in the same rooms that they took place in my real life. And of all those scenes, near the end of the film, when John is really struggling with mistakes he's made, and who hasn't? I'm having a conversation with my dad on the screened-in porch, and my dad is just reminding me that, John, the can of gasoline blew up 24 years ago.
Mm.
It's not chasing you anymore. And that conversation took place on that screened-in porch with the same birds singing. And so when I hear my dad's voice in the film echo what I heard from my actual father say to me in the same place where it occurred, it's, again, another gripping moment.
Yeah. What did the neighbors think?
For the vast majority, they loved it, man. Hollywood showed up, hundreds of vehicles. It's madness. It's like the circus moves in. They spend a couple days there. They do a couple acts. They juggle a few balls, and then they leave, but they clean everything up.
Mm-hmm.
And Elaine, they were dedicated enough that my mom and dad have had new floors done in their house since the fire.
Mm-hmm.
They went back and put in the old floors. And then after they got done shooting that scene, went back and put in my mom and dad's current floors. So they wanted to make this thing feel as 1987 as possible,
okay.
And they crushed it. They just did a phenomenal job.
Well, you know, everything does come back at some point. So and people are going to be telling stories about the filming for years to come, surely.
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of us are now, you know, B-level celebrities walking by while they're shooting some film.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot of Easter eggs in this. You saw the film,
okay.
And you saw... I'm sure you saw some interns. You heard that over the last break.
Yes.
But there are some wonderful St. Louis folks who are part of this film, and I'm not going to yell them all out.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them is Jack Buck's granddaughter.
Oh.
So her name is Natalie Buck.
Okay.
And she's an actor herself, but she came in. She participates in the film Soul on Fire. She's the nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And when Jack Buck walks out of John's room and says, level with me, kid won't make it, will he? The nurse who says, no. There's just not a chance.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
That's Natalie Buck.
Oh.
And so here she is on camera looking up at a man who looks just like Jack Buck speaking to her grandfather. So a very cool moment there.
It must have been a trip.
Well, she cried like a baby. Every day that she was
gosh.
On set, it was very emotional for Natalie.
Lots of tissues around. This then brings up a question about who this film was made for.
Right.
Who was it made for, John?
Well, a long time ago, people told me niche to get rich. Like, know that you want to become an insurance speaker and that's where you should work. Or speak to restaurant leaders and that's where you should work. And instead, I speak to anybody. From third graders to prisoners to CEOs to 27,000 at the MGM. I'll go. Like, let's serve. This film has that same desire. And what we're hearing from the responses is, I assumed that middle-aged leaders would love it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that would work. What I did not expect is that prisoners would love it. What I did not expect is that a child would reach out to me from California, say to me, it was a coming-of-age movie. I came in a child. I left a young person. I did not expect to hear from a Vietnam vet in Sacramento saying, John, I came home after two doors. I haven't felt emotion in more than 40 years. I cried your entire film, and now I have joy in my heart again. I didn't make it for those folks. But I think when you speak truth with vulnerability for others, it draws them into the conversation and reminds them that the miracle that is so clearly on display in this film can indeed be on display in theirs.
Mm-hmm. How are you keeping all of these responses? Like, is there some way that you're storing them, not just mentally, but in one place?
So pathetically right now, it is an email. Those that are sent to us at our little office, they actually go into a pile that I get to read and hold on to. What I'll say to answer your question differently, I love the responses from individuals. I have no interest in reading critics. None. Even if they're giving glowing praise, I think the term critic speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. Let me know how the film moved you, though. Now we can do life together. So I savor the child, the veteran, the inmate who tells me what the film has done for them in their life.
Mm-hmm. What did it feel like in particular to have the veteran share that story?
Well, my favorite organization to partner with, Big Brothers Big Sisters, is one of them. But side by side with them is called Focus Marines. So I've had the honor of serving these guys quarterly for the last 13 years. I know what it's like then through their experience to lay down their life for their country. Even if their life wasn't taken back then, they offered up something and they lost something. Mm. And these are guys that I would fight for. These are guys I would lay down my life for. So to receive a random note from a random Marine in Sacramento, California, saying he feels again and there's joy in his heart. If the movie only touched him, we did our job. Mm-hmm. Like that, we win.
Yeah. Before we end, I want to make a point of talking about St. Louis. This film created more than 550 jobs for Missourians, and it generated nearly $6.9 million of in-state spending. And this is according to the St. Louis Film Office. What does that mean for the future of other projects that are not aimed at critics, but for people, for us?
The most surprising thing throughout the filming was not the humility and humanity of the actors, although that blew me away. It was the thank yous from guys working craft services, from the folks who drove cars and vans, who set up our trucks. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people went back to work through this one film. I believe there are 9 additional projects that are lined up behind this one. Sean McNamara's got another one that's going to make 10. To put our friends and our neighbors and our family members back to work in our state, to rebuild up this industry in our state, what it tells me, Elaine, is it's bigger than Soul on Fire. That's a movie, and it's a moment in time, and it's beautiful. Go see it this weekend, please. Opening weekend matters. Vote with your time, please. And recognize, and others are following. Mm-hmm. So we have almost a dozen movies that are lining up behind Soul on Fire.
Yeah. And as we end here, what is right now your favorite part of the movie? What's the one that you find yourself talking about most with people?
There's a scene that I'm not going to go into at the end of the film. So you saw it. But the very, very, very final scene ends up in the same stadium where John O'Leary had John O'Leary Day at the ballpark. Bush Stadium 2 is that one. The final scene is at Bush Stadium 3. And what happens there and the impact of it in my life and someone else's life and what it means for our viewers will always touch my heart.
John O'Leary is the author, motivational speaker, and executive producer of a feature film that is about his life. It's called Soul on Fire, and it releases tomorrow in the U.S. and in Canada. John, thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck with this release.
Thank you, Elaine.
This episode was produced by Darius Varner.
Audio engineering and sound design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.